Hi, this is Thelma English, and I'm going to be reading to you today from Book 9 of Virgil's Aeneid. I'm reading from the Robert Fitzgerald translation of Virgil's Aeneid. Make sure you have your book with you, and turn to Book 9, please. In Book 9, the action is just 2 days. Only 2 days take place, and then an intervening night, and the nighttime activity is really important. So Aeneas is gone. He's with King Evander, and he's making a best friend of Pallas, and his people miss him dearly. Aeneas is off, you know, visiting Evander, and he's almost like a father to him. He's a father figure with his own father, Anchises, dead. In this chapter, believe it or not, the Trojan ships are going to turn into sea nymphs because they're made from special wood. And we have two men, Nisu and Euryalus, who are going to make a night raid. And this is very similar to the Iliad Book 10, when Odysseus and Diomedes go off for a night raid. So this has lots of similarities with the Iliad. Book 9. While all these differing actions were afoot in the far distance, Juno from high air sent Iris down to Turnus. As it chanced, that day the rash prince rested in the grove of his forebear Pilumnus in a valley blessed of old. There Iris, she's the female messenger goddess, rose-lipped child of Thaumas, told him. So Iris is coming to Turnus, and she's got a message, and she's going to say, Turnus, Aeneas is gone. He's not with his troops. He's off visiting Evander. Go attack his people now. Go attack now. So she says, Turnus, what no god would dare to promise you your heart's desire, the course of time has of itself brought on. Leaving his town and ships and followers, Aeneas journeyed to the Palatine court of Evander. Still unsatisfied, he's gone to distant hamlets of Corythus to rally and arm the Lydian countrymen. Why hesitate? Now is the time. Sound the call for cavalry and war cars, chariots. Now! Break off this lull. Strike at their flurried camp. Take it by storm. On even wings she rose into the sky, inscribing her great bow, the rainbow, in flight upon the clouds. He knew her sign, and lifting both his hands to starry heaven, sent these words after her. Glory of the sky! Who brought you down to me, cloud-born on earth? What makes the sudden brilliance of the air? I see the vault of heaven riven, and stars that drift across the night sky. I'll obey this great presage, no matter who you are who call me to attack. Then riverward, he, Turnus, took his way, and from the surface drew pure lustral water. Then he heaped his vows plenteously on heaven. So he's very pious, remember, he's always offering vows and making offerings. Soon his offering, at full strength, moved out through open land, studded with riders with dyed cloaks and gold, Messapus commanding the forward units, Tiresias' son the rear, Turnus the center. And what was it like? As the Ganges, that's a river, as Ganges fed by 7 tranquil streams, flows high and quietly, or Nile goes full in a seaward channel, when the encircling flood ebbs from the fields at last. That's what it's like. A distant cloud in black dust mounting up, a darkness rising suddenly on the plain, came to the eyes of Trojan lookouts. Then Caicus yelled from the rampart facing inland, "Countrymen, what is the mass of men there on the plain in a dark cloud of dust? Take arms, be quick, hand missiles out and spears and man the walls. Here comes the enemy, on guard." In tumult, back to the camp, through all the gates retiring, Trojans took positions on the walls, for so on his departure their best soldier Aeneas had instructed them, if any emergency arose, not to do battle, not to entrust their fortunes to the field, but safe behind their walls to hold the camp. So Aeneas's men, very anti-Roman-like, Aeneas's men have been instructed that if they get attacked, they're supposed to just go in and hide. Therefore, though shame and anger tempted them to a pitched battle, even so they barred the gates, as he commanded, and compact in towers, armed, awaited the enemy. Turnus, riding hard, had left the slow main column far behind. Now he turned up before the camp with 20 chosen horsemen, a Thracian piebald, that's a horse that has big patches of color on it, and Thracians, remember, they're very fierce, so a Thracian horse would be a very fierce horse, with his mount, his helm, all golden, with a crimson plume. He shouted, "Who will it be, men? Who will join with me to open the attack? Look here!" He cast high in the air his spinning javelin, first in that fight. Then the tall horseman rode straight onward in the open field. His troop took up the cry and galloped after him with a wild din, yelling astonishment at Trojans' faint hearts. "They won't risk themselves in the open for a fair fight. Won't come down to stand up to us. How they hug the camp!" Now Turnus furiously this way and that rode round the walls and looked for a way in where there was none. And what was it like? As a wolf on the prowl round a full sheepfold howls at crevices, enduring wind and rain at dead of night, while nestled safe under the ewes, the lambs keep up their bleating. That's how it was. He, beside himself, tormented by accumulated hunger, draws a thirst for blood, and all his fury cannot reach them, rend them. So the Rutulian, Turnus, flared up with helpless rage at what he saw of walls and camp, a fever in his bones. How could he work an entrance? By what course dislodge the shut-in Trojans from their rampart? In other words, how can he get them to come out? Get them to issue on the plain. The fleet! Ah, his fleet of ships. Next to the camp it lay, shielded by earthworks on the land side and by the running stream. He rode for it, calling his cheering men to bring up fire. And he himself, inflamed, took up a blazing pine torch in his hand. Then, as his presence urged them on, they all rode to and fro in earnest to arm themselves with evil torches, tearing campfires apart as fuming brands gave off a pitchy glare, and Vulcan, Hephaestus, clouded heaven with smoke and ash. Now, which of the immortals, Muse, addressing the Muse again, dispelled that cruel conflagration from the Trojans? Who turned those fires from the ships? Tell me their old belief and the eternal tale. In those days, when Aeneas shaped his fleet on Phrygian Ida, on Trojan Mount Ida, and prepared to sail the deep sea, then the mother of the gods, the barren Cynthian, addressed great Jove. The barren Cynthian is Cybele, the mother goddess of Phrygia, addressed great Jove. "So now Olympus owns your mastery. Grant your dear mother what she asks of you. There was a forest of pines I loved for years, a grove high on the mountain crest, where men brought offerings to me, a dusky place with dark pine trees, and a tall stand of maple. These I gladly gave to the Dardan Trojan prince when he required a fleet. But now a pang of fear has made my heart contract. Relieve my anguish. Let your mother's plea avail in this, that those ship's timbers not be breached or swamped on any course by any storm, but let their birth and growth here on our mountains prosper them all." So Cybele has these special wood that she has allowed them to build ships out of, but she has made them promise they'll never let them burn or be destroyed. But in reply, her son, who makes the firmament revolve, demurred, "What, swerving mother, do you ask of fate? What privilege for these, your ships? Shall hulls that mortal hands have made enjoy a right that only immortals have? And shall Aeneas go secure through insecurities and dangers? Which of the gods can wield that power? Rather, when they have done their work and moored in the Ausonian ports, Italian ports one day, those ships that have escaped the storm waves and brought home the Dardan hero to Laurentine lands, then I shall strip away their mortal shape and make them, at my bidding, goddesses of the great deep, like Dato, Nereus's child, and Galatea in the mid-sea foam, breasting their way." So the ships, when they finish their job taking the Trojans to Italy, they get to turn into sea nymphs. So ran the pledge of Jove, who we call also Jupiter or Zeus, ratified when by his Stygian brothers' rivers. The Stygian is an adjective for the river Styx, which would mean his hell's brother. Styx is one of the rivers in hell. So this is referring to Pluto. His Stygian brother's rivers, boiling banks and black whirlpool, he took oath nodding. So he made an oath by the Styx. Remember, you can't break an oath made by the Styx, making all Olympus tremble at his nod. Now then, the promised hour had come. The overshadowing fates had filled the appointed time. Now havoc planned by Turnus roused the mother to keep away his firebrands and from her blessed halls. Excuse me. Fresh light shone in men's eyes. A great cloud from the east appeared to storm across the sky with Ida's retinue of Cybele. Now, Cybele is the goddess of nature. She's very wild. Her retinue is wild demons. So it appeared across the sky with Ida's retinue of Cybele. So this is the wild goddess of nature and a bunch of demons. Then a voice to chill the blood came falling through the air and reached all ranks, Rutilian and Trojan. No desperate rallying to defend my ships, you Trojans. No equipping men for that. Turnus may sooner fire the sea itself than hulls of holy pine. Ships, now, go free. Go as sea goddesses. Your mother sends you. So she just says to the ships, go free. Each broke her hawser instantly, so the ropes break. Their bows went under like a school of dolphins. What was it like when the ships turned into dolphins? Basically, like a school of dolphins, diving into the depths, then wondrously came up. So many virgin forms now seaward bound. The astounded troop drew back as horses reared. Miasap, even he was terrified. The river halted in a raucous noise as Tiber turned back from the sea. But Turnus's fiery confidence held. In quick response, he blazed at them to give them heart. So Turnus is talking to his men. You know, these wonders are all aimed at the Trojans. Jove himself has robbed them of their usual ally, not waiting for our swords and fires to do it. So Turnus is trying to make this a sign from Jove in their favor. The open sea is closed to Trojans now. Now they have no way out. That element is taken from them, and dry land is ours, where all the tribes of Italy, men in thousands, take up arms. Those fateful oracles, so called, on which the Phrygians plume themselves, terrify me not in the least. Even and more has now been granted fate and Venus. Seeing the Trojans reach Ausonian Italian lands, I have my fate as well to combat theirs, to cut this criminal people down, my bride, Lavinia, being stolen. Pain over such a loss is not for the Atridae only. Remember, the Atridae is patronymics for Agamemnon and Menelaus. Nor may only Mycenae justly have recourse to arms. Because Mycenae, when Helen was stolen. Enough that Trojans perished once, their sin that once had been enough, were they not still given to hatred of all womankind. This is the first I've read of the Trojans hating all women. Do they get their courage from a wall between us, ditches to put us off, a paltry space from massacre for them? Did they not see the walls of Troy, built up by Neptune's hand, collapse in flames? Which one of you picked men is ready for his blade to breach their wall and rush their flustered camp with me? I need no arms from Vulcan, nor 1,000 ships to take these Trojans on, because Achilles had arms from Vulcan, from Hephi. The Greeks, you know, he doesn't need armor from Vulcan, and he doesn't need 1,000 ships. Because remember, the Greeks came in 1,000 ships to attack Troy. He doesn't need armor from Vulcan or 1,000 ships to take these Trojans on. Let the Etruscans, this is just north of Latium, let the Etruscans all be quick to join them as allies. They need not fear sneak thievery by night of their palladium, guards on the height cut down, nor will we hide in a horse's pitch-dark belly, referring to he will not get into this city by building a Trojan horse to sneak in. We won't hide in a horse pitch dark belly. Openly by day I'll have their ramparts ringed with flame, by God. I'll see to it they won't suppose they're fighting with Danaans, Greeks. Pelasgian troops Hector held off for 10 years. Now then, seeing the day's best hours are done, be of good cheer, men. After the day's good action, rest and be fed. A fight's in preparation, you can be sure of that. Meanwhile, and our book says in the interim, and what that means is, meanwhile, Messapus had the duty of placing men outside the gates and watch fires round the ramparts. 14 officers were assigned to guard the perimeter, with 100 men to each, in crimson-helmed plumes and glinting gold. Scattering to their posts, they manned the watch by turns and settled on the grass at ease to drink their wine, tipping the brazen bowls. The campfires gave them light, and wakeful sentries passed the night in gaming. Okay, so they have a whole bunch of watchfires too, which is a little bit reminiscent of the Iliad. From their ramparts overlooking the scene, the Trojans watched. Anxiously they had tried and braced the gates, joined catwalks to their battlements, and brought fresh missiles up. Menestheus had charge of this with grim Serestus, for the Lord Aeneas appointed them, if a crisis called for it, to keep order in troops and settlement. On the alert along the walls, the legion faced from the danger, each his share of it, guarding in turn what each one had to guard. Nisus guarded a gate, a man-at-arms with a fighting heart. Hyrtacus's son, the huntress Idas, had sent him to Aeneas' side. So this is going to be the night raid. This is very similar to, in comparison to Iliad Book 10, with Rhesus, when Odysseus and Diomedes go in and Rhesus has just come from Thrace, and he has all these Thracian horses. So they're really fierce fighters and fierce horses. And Odysseus and Diomedes go in and kill all the men and steal all the horses that are fresh horses. So this is very similar to this. So Nisus and Eurybiles are going to go and make a night raid. The huntress Idas had sent him to Aeneas' side, line 244. A quick hand with a javelin and arrows. Eurylus was his comrade, handsomer than any other soldier of Aeneas, wearing the Trojan gear, a boy whose cheek bore through unshaven manhood's early down. One love united them, and side by side they entered combat, as that night they held the gate on the same watch. And Nisus said, "This urge to action, do the gods instill it, or is each man's desire a god to him, Euryalus? Euryalus, for all these hours I've longed to engage in battle, or to try some great adventure. In this lull I cannot rest. You see how confident the Rutulians are, Turnus's people. Their watchfire lights wink few and far between. They've all lain down in wine and drowsiness, and the whole place is quiet. Now attend to a thought I'm turning over in my mind, a plan that grows on me. Recall Aeneas. Everyone, seniors, all our folk demand. Dispatch men to report to them. Will they not promise the reward I ask of you? The glory of the feat's enough for me. Below that rise of ground there, I can find, I think, a way through to Fort Pelentium. So Nisus thinks he can get through to go get Aeneas. Taken aback, his love of glory stirred, Euryalus replied to his ardent friend, "And me? Are you refusing me my place beside you in this great affair? Must I send you alone into such danger? Born for that was I, and trained for that amid the Argive, the Greek terror. Those hard hours of Troy, by a true fighter, one inured to battle, my father Opheltes. Never till now have I behaved so at your side, and as a soldier pledged to see Aeneas's destiny through. Believe me, here's a spirit that disdains mere daylight. I hold life well spent to buy that glory you aspire to." Nisus answered, "Not for a minute had I any qualms about you on that score. Unthinkable. Witness great Jupiter, or whoever else may favor this attempt, by bringing me in triumph back to you. But if some god or accident defeats me, and one sees miscarriage of bold missions many a time, you must live on. Your age deserves more life, so he's younger. If I'm dragged free from a fight or ransomed, let there be someone who can bury me. Or if, as often bad luck rules that out, someone who can carry out the ritual for me, though I'm not there, and honor me with an empty tomb. Then, too, I would not bring such grief on your poor mother, one who dared as many mothers did not, child, to come this far with you, taking no care for shelter behind Acestes' walls, the king of Sicily. She did not stay back behind in Sicily. His mother, Euryalus' mother, is a very brave woman." But the boy said, "Your reasoning is all a waste of breath. Not by an inch has my position changed. Let's be off." With this he roused the watch, men who came up to stand guard in their turn, and he took his relief, matching his stride with Nisus, and they sought the prince of Troy. So Nisus and Euryalus leave the walled city, and they go looking for Aeneas. Each Earth's other creatures now had given over care and sleep, forgetful of their toil, but the high Trojan captains, chosen men, held counsel on the realm's pressing affairs. What action should they take, or who should be their messenger to Aeneas? In the open mid-court of the camp, leaning on spears, gripping their shields, they stood. And Nisus came, Euryalus beside him, eager men, who begged for a quick hearing, line 320, saying how grave the matter was, worth a commander's time. Eulius, at scanning, moved first to hear the excited pair, ordering Nisus to speak out, and he did so, saying, "Soldiers of Aeneas, listen with open minds, and let what we propose be looked on without reference to our years. So we have a plan, and don't just tell us no before you hear it just because we're young. The Rutulians, Turnus's men, have quieted down. Their wine has put them all to sleep, but we make out an opening for a sortie, like a little attack. Where the road divides there at the gate nearest the sea, a gap at that point in their line of fires, with only black smoke rising. If you let us take advantage of this to find our way to Aeneas and Pelentium, you'll see us back with plunder before long, and slaughter done. No fear the path will fool us. Many times hunting these valleys, we've come in view of the town's outposts, and we know the river, the whole course of it." Bowed by weight of years and ripe of mind, Aletes here exclaimed, gods of our fathers, in whose shadow Troy forever lives, you are not after all intent on wiping out the Teucrians, the Trojans, seeing you've given our fighters daring souls and resolute hearts like these. And as he spake, he took each by the shoulder, took his hand while tears ran down his cheeks. What fit rewards for this brave action, soldiers, shall I reckon we can make to you? The best of all the gods will give, and your own sense of duty. Then our devout Aeneas will recompense you in other ways, and soon so will Ascanius, young as he is. Never will he forget a feat of this distinction. Here Ascanius broke in, so Aeneas' son. Never indeed, as my well-being wholly depends on father's coming back. By our great household gods, by our hearth god, Lar of Asarcus, this is the great-grandfather of Aeneas, by white-haired Vesta's holy chapel, Nisus, hear my vow. Whatever fortune I may have, whatever hope, I now commit to both of you. Recall my father. Bring him before my eyes. With him recovered, nothing can be grim. So if they can just bring back Aeneas, all will be well. Then I shall give two cups, well-shaped in silver, rough with embossing, that my father took the day Arisba fell. That's a city in the Troy area. Twin tripods, too. Two gold bars and an ancient wine bowl. Gift of Dido the Sidonian. More than this, if it should happen that my father wins the land and throne of Italy and divides by lot the captured booty, well, you've seen the mount that Turnus rode. Okay, so his horse, the arms he bore, his armor, all golden. I exempt that mount, that shield and crimson-crested helmet from allotment, even now to be your trophies. Nisus. Father will reward you, too, with 12 deep breasted beauties, and 12 captive men, each with his armor. Beyond these, whatever private lands that the king Latinus owns, the king of Laurentium and Latium, the father of Lavinia, the private lands that King Latinus owns. But as for you, whose age my own approaches, young but so admirable, I embrace you with my whole heart, and say you'll be my friend in all future adventures. There shall be no labor for distinction in my life, in wartime or in time of peace, without you. Whether in speech or action, all my trust goes now to you. Euryalus answered him, "The day will never come when I shall prove unequal to this kind of mission. Hard and daring as it is, if only fortune turns to our benefit and not against us. One gift above all gifts I ask of you. My mother comes of the old stock of Priam, and she is here, poor lady. Ilium, her homeland, Troy is her homeland, could not keep her, neither could Acestes' city walls, so she refused to stay back at Sicily. From following me, I leave her ignorant of the risks I run, with no leave-taking. So I'm not telling my mother that I'm going. I let the present night and your sworn arm be witnesses. I could not endure my mother's tears. Will you, I beg, console her in her deprivation? Help her if she is left without me. Let me take that expectation of your care along. I shall face danger with a lighter heart." So Euryalus says, "Don't tell my mother I'm gone. And if I don't come back, will you please take care of my mother?" This moved the Dardan, the Trojan officers, to tears. Ascanius, Ilius, most of all, thoughts of his own devotion to his father wrung his heart. When he had wept, he said, so Ascanius says, "Be aware of it. All here will be conducted worthily of the great thing you undertake. That mother will be mine, only the name Creusa wanting to her, and I shall not stint in gratitude for parenthood so noble. Whatever comes of your attempt, I swear, as once my father did, by my own life, that all I promise on your safe return holds likewise for your mother and your kin." So he spoke out in tears, and from his shoulder lifted on its belt his gilded sword, a marvel of craft. It had been forged and fitted to an ivory sheath by the Gnosian Lycaon. To Nisus Menestheus gave a lion's pelt, and shaggy mane and steadfast old Aletes made an exchange of helmets. Both now armed, they set out, followed to the gate by all the company of officers. You might remember the thing about the lion's pelt and the helmet. All of that is unique to Iliad Book 10. The company of offers with prayers, line 435, from young and old, and in particular, princely Iulius Ascanius, thoughtful, responsible beyond his years, gave many messages to carry to his father. These the winds of heaven scattered, every one unheard, and puffed them to the clouds. All right, this is foreshadowing, foreboding, which means all these messages Ascanius gives them to tell to his father, none of them are going to reach Aeneas. So now we kind of know what's going to happen. All right, Nisus and Euryalus, these are Trojans who were mentioned early in the Aeneid in Book 5. And they're doing a raid on this Rutulian camp. The messengers now issued from the gate, traversed the trench, and made their way through darkness toward the encampment, deadly to them. Still, before the end, they were to bring a bloody death on many. Now everywhere they saw, in drunken sleep, lax bodies on the grass, up-tilted chariots along the river, forms of men at rest amid the reins and wheels, arms lying there where wine cups also lay. The first to speak was Nisus, and he said, "Euryalus, here I must dare to use my sword. The case cries out for it. Our path lies there. But you keep watch. Keep well alert all around about for any stroke against us from behind. Ahead, I'll devastate them right and left and take you through." Because Euryalus is a little older. He broke off whispering to lunge at Romney's, the proud man propped up on rugs and snoring loud, lungs full of sleep. A king himself and augur to King Turnus. Now by no augury could he dispel his evil hour. Three of his bodyguards who lay nearby, at random by their spears, Nisus dispatched. Then Remus's armorer, and then his charioteer, discovered prone under the very horse's feet. The swordsman slashed their drooping necks. Then he beheaded Remus himself, their lord, and left the trunk to spout dark blood. Notice even Remus's name is almost the same as Rhesus in Iliad Book 10. By the warm blood, the ground and bedding were all soaked. Next, Lamyrus and Lammas died, and so did Serranus, a handsome soldier who had played at dice that night for hours and now lay undone by abundant Bacchus. He drank too much wine. Luckily, this man had made his gambling last night into the dawn. So too bad this guy didn't stay up all night gambling. Then he would have saved himself. And what was it like? Think of an unfed lion havocing crowded sheepfolds, being driven mad by hunger. How with his jaws he rends and mauls the soft flock dumb with fear, and growls and feeds with bloody maw. Euryalus carried out equal slaughter, all inflamed as he too fell upon the nameless ranks of sleeping soldiery. Then he attacked Phaedus, Herberus, Rhoeteus, Abarus, unconscious men. But Rhoetus came awake and took in everything, struck dumb with fear, trying to hide behind a huge wine bowl. Full in the chest as he arose, the Trojan plunged his blade up to the hilt and drew it backward, streaming death. Dying, the man belched out his crimson life, wine mixed with blood as the hot killer, like a cat, pressed on. He came then to Messapus's company, their fires burning low, their tethered horses grazing the meadow. But now Nisus spoke in a curt whisper, for he saw his friend carried away by slaughter and lust for blood. "Let us have done," he said. "The dawn's at hand and dangerous. We've made them pay enough. We've cut our way through." Turning now, they left a quantity of booty. Solid silver armor, wine bowls, handsome rugs. Euryalus took medals and a gold-studded belt from Ramnes, gifts the rich man, Caedicus, in the old days, had sent to Remulus of Tibur as a distant guest friend on Zenia pledge. And Remulus at death had passed them on to his own grandson, at whose death in war the Rutilians had got them. These the boy tore off and fitted on his torso, tough and stalwart as it was, though all in vain. Then donned Messapus's helm with its high plume as the marauders put the camp behind them, making for safety. At that hour, horsemen sent away from the city of Latinus, other troops being halted on the plain, came bringing answers to the prince, to Turnus. Horsemen 300 strong, all bearing shields with Volscens in command, nearing the camp and riding toward the rampart, they caught sight of the two Trojans over there who veered on the leftward path. Euryalus's helmet, in the clear night's half-darkness, had betrayed him, glimmering back as he had not foreseen dim rays of moonlight. And the horsemen took sharp notice of that sight. Troop leader Volscens shouted, "Soldiers, halt! What's this patrol? Who are you two in arms there, and where bound?" They offered no reply to him, but made all speed into a wood, putting their trust in darkness here. There, troopers rode left and right. Remember, there's 300 guys on horses. Troopers rode left and right to place themselves at the familiar byways until they had the wood encircled, every exit under guard. The wood itself covered much ground, all bristling underbrush, dark ilex, its holly, and dense briars everywhere, the path a rare trace amid tracks grown over. Deep down under the boughs and weight of booty slowed Euryalus, and fear confused him as to the pathway. Nisus, unsuspecting, got free of the wood, escaped the foe, ran past the place places later known as Alban, Latinus's high-fenced castle pastures in, but all at once he stopped and looked around in vain for his lost friend. Aurelius! Poor fellow, where did I lose you? Where shall I hunt for you? Back along all that winding way? That maze of woodland? Backward in his tracks as he recalled them, now he went, and strayed through silent undergrowth. He heard the horses, heard the clamor and calls of the pursuit, and after no long interval a cry came to his ears. Aurelius now he saw, set upon by the whole troop, first undone by darkness and the treacherous terrain, now overwhelmed by the sudden rush of men, who dragged him off, though right and left he strove. Now what could Nisus do? What strength had he? What weapons could he dare a rescue with? Should he then launch himself straight at the foe, though many wounds hastened? Heroic death? His arm drawn back, hefting his javelin, he glanced at the high, quiet moon and prayed, "Thou goddess," so he's praying to Latona's daughter, Diana Artemis, "Thou goddess, thou be near and help my effort, Latona's daughter, glory of the stars and guardian of the groves. If Hyrtacus, my father, ever brought gifts to thy altars, votive gifts for me, if I myself have honored thee out of my hunting spoils with offerings, hung in thy dome or fixed outside thy sacred roof, now let me throw this troop into confusion, guide my weapon through the air." He made the cast with all the force and spring of his whole body, and through the darkness of the night, the javelin, whipping on, hit Somel's back and snapped there, putting a splinter through his diaphragm. The man rolled on the ground and vomited a hot flood, even as he himself grew chill with long convulsions. All the rest peered round this way, then that way. All the more savagely the assailant hefts a second javelin back to his ear. Now see commotion, hear the whizzing shaft. It splits the skull of Tagus side to side and sticks in the cleft hot brain. Now Volscens, in a wild rage, nowhere saw the man who threw the missile, could not tell in what quarter to hurl himself. "All right," he said, "you then, you'll pay with your hot blood for both my men." And with his sword unsheathed, he went straight for Aurelius. Now, truly mad with terror, Nisus cried aloud. He could not hide in darkness any longer, could not bear his anguish any longer, because Nisus is hiding, and he's thrown two spears, but Aurelius is captured, and they're going to kill him, because the other two guys got killed because they can't see where it's coming from. And so he says, "No, me, here I am. I did it. Take your swords to me, Rutulians. All the trickery was mine. He had not dared to do anything. He could not. Heaven's my witness, and the stars that look down on us. All he did was care too much for a luckless friend." But while he clamored, Volscens' blade thrust hard, passed through the ribs and breached the snow-white crest. Aurelius in death went reeling down, and blood streamed on his handsome length. His neck collapsing, let his head fall on his shoulder. What was it like when his head fell on his shoulder? As a bright flower cut by a passing plough will droop and wither slowly, or a poppy bow its head upon its tired stalk when overborne by a passing rain. Plunged ahead. That's what it was like. Now Nisus plunged ahead into the crowd of men and made for Volscens only, of them all, concerned only with Volscens. All around him enemies grouped to meet him, fend him off to left and right, but onward all the same he pressed his charge, swirling his lightning blade until he sank it in the yelling visage straight before him. So he took that life even as he died himself. Line 630. Pierced everywhere, he pitched down on the body of his friend, and there at last, in the peace of death, grew still. And now Virgil steps out of voice and speaks to the audience. "Fortunate both, if in the least my songs avail, no future day will ever take you out of the record of remembering time, while children of Aeneas make their home around the capital's unshaken rock, and still the Roman father governs all." The Rutulians, these are Turnus's men, now victors with their trophies, bore the dead Volscens into camp with tears, and tears flowed in the camp as well, at finding Ramnes bled to death and many captains taken off at one stroke in that slaughter, even as Numa and Serranus were. A great crowd pressed around the dead and dying, pressed it toward the ground, still fresh with carnage, foaming rills of blood. The men could recognize the trophies there and point them out. Messapus's shining helm, the medals now regained that had cost toil and sweat in the attack. By this time, early dawn, leaving Tithonus, this is the son of Laomedon, who's beloved of Aurora, the dawn, early dawn, leaving Tithonus's yellow bed, scattered first rays of light over the lands of earth. Down poured the sun, the world stood clear. Line 655. And Turnus in full armor roused his men to arm. Each officer drew up his line of battle all in bronze, and soldiers gave their anger a fighting edge, with divers, which means various, versions of the night attack. The attackers' heads, indeed, a ghastly sight. They fixed on spears, and lifted and bore out in taunting parade. So they have Euryalus and Nisus's heads on poles. Aeneas's men, Euryalus and Nisus, Aeneas's men-at-arms on the left flank formed their defending line along the walls, the right enclosed by river. On high towers, having the ditch before them broad and deep, they stood in sorrow, moved by those grim heads, impaled in dripping gore, heads too well known to their unhappy fellows. In the meantime, rumor on strong winds flying went about the settlement in dread, until it whispered close by Euryalus's mother's ears. Then all at once warm life drained from her body. Scuttle and skein unwound dropped from her hands. She flew outdoors, all wretchedness, and wailed as women do, tearing her hair, and ran to reach the rampart, in mad haste to reach the front line. Pain soldiers there, no heed to danger, none to missiles. Then she filled heaven's air with keening, which would be loud mourning. Must I see you even like this, Euryalus? You that were in the last days the comfort of my age, could leave me, could you, cruel boy, alone, sent into danger so? Had you no time for your poor mother's last farewell? Ah, God, you lie now in a strange land, carrion for Latin dogs and birds, and I, your mother, never took you, your body out for burial, nor closed your eyes, nor washed your wounds, nor dressed you in the fine robe I had been weaving for you, night and day in haste, before the loom, easing an old woman's pain. But where shall I go now? Where is the earth that holds your trunk dismembered, all your mangled body? Remember, she needs to bury him. This, is this all of yourself, my son, that you bring back to me by sea and land? Do I keep this beside me? Put your spears into me, Rutulians, she says to the enemy. If you can be moved, let fly your javelins all at me, and let me be the first you kill, or else take pity, father of the great gods, with your bolt. Dispatch this hateful soul to the abyss. I cannot else break off my tortured life. So she wants Zeus himself to throw a thunderbolt at her and kill her. All hearts were shaken by her cries, and groans of mourning came from all, their strength for battle broken and benumbed. At the behest of Ilioneus and Euryalus, weeping hard, the woman, as she fanned the flame of grief, was brought inside, supported on the arms of Actor and Aeneas, and given rest. But now a far-off trumpet sang in bronze, heart-chilling clamor, and a battle shout re-echoed from the sky, as Volscens charged under cover of the shields, evenly locked to fill the moat and tear the rampart down. Some tried to find a way over in and with scaling ladders, at points lightly manned, where gaps showed in the high line of defenders, not so close packed. But the Trojans, trained in their long war, remember they fought 10 years at Troy, knew how to hold a wall. They rained all kinds of missiles down and used tough poles to push off climbers. Stones as well of deadly weight they rolled and tumbled over to crack the shield-roofed ranks. Nevertheless, beneath a tortoise shell so thick all the shields altogether resembled a tortoise shell, those troops were glad to take their chances. Yet the time came when they could not. Where the massed attackers threatened, Trojans trundled a mass of stone and heaved it down to fell men in a swath and smashed their armored shell. Now Rutulians no longer cared to fight blind under shields, but strove to clear the wall with archery. Mezentius, in his quarter of the field, a sight to quail at, shook his Etruscan pine, his firebrand, and lobbed in smoking darts. Messapus, Neptune's child, tamer of horses, breached a wall and called for scaling ladders. Calliope, I pray, so Virgil is invoking the muse again, and muses all, inspire me as I sing the bloody work, line 741. The death dealt out by Turnus on that day, and tell what men each fighter sent to Orcus. Orcus is the going to hell. It's a death god shown with a great big gaping open mouth and real hairy head. Orcus, help me to spread the massive page of war. There was one tower of commanding height and served by catwalks in a walks in a strategic place. Italian troops with might and main struggled to conquer this or bring it down with every trick of siege. As for their part, the Trojans held it with a hail of stones and shafts they shot through loopholes. Turnus now became the first, with his thrown torch to lodge a fire in the tower's side. Blazing up there with wind, it caught the planks and clung around the portals. It consumed. The garrison, in panic at this horror, having no exit, herded to that side, still free of deadly fire. But the tower, under the sudden shift of weight, went down, all heaven thundering with its crash. Men dropped half dead with all that mass of ruin to earth, impaled on their own weapons, or run through by cruel splinters. Lycus and Helenor barely escaped, the only ones. The young Helenor, whom a slave, Licymnia, had borne in secret to Maeonia's king and sent to Troy, although forbidden arms, with naked sword and shield blank, bare of deeds. Now, as he saw himself amid 1,000 troops of Turnus, ranks of Latins waiting here and others there. So this poor guy that was a slave that they brought back, and he's not even allowed to have weapons. How does he fight? As a wild beast, pinned by a band of hunters in a ring, will rage against their spears and hurl himself upon sure death, with one leapt on the spear points. In the same way, the young man facing death rushed at the enemy, and where he saw the spears were thickest, there he aimed his charge. But Lycus, being far quicker on his feet, made for and gained the wall amid the enemy, amid their missiles, trying to reach the top and outstretched hands of friends. But on his heels ran Turnus with his spear, and won the race, taunting him. "Did you hope to get away, you madman, from our hands?" And taking hold of the man hanging there, he tore him down with a big chunk of wall. What was it like? As when the bird who bears Jove's bolt, the eagle, takes wing, lugging a hare, carrying a rabbit, or snowy swan aloft in crooked talons, or when Mars wolf steals from the fold a lamb whose mother bleeding seeks it. Everywhere the shouting rose as Rutulians fought onward, filling the moat with piled up earth, while some tossed high upon the rooftops burning brands, casting a stone, a piece of mountain crag. Ilonius brought down Lucetius as he approached a gate carrying fire. Liger killed Emathion, and Asilas killed Corymchius, a javelin man won over a bowsman deftness from a distance. Canis brought Ortygius down, and Canis, even as he triumphed, fell to Turnus. Turnus then killed Itys and Clinius, Dixapius and Promulus, then Sagaris and Idas, high on the battlement. But Capys killed Privernus. First, Themela's point had grazed him, so that he lost his head and threw his shield down, bringing his hand up to the wound. Therefore the winging arrow sank in his left side, and deeply embedded broke the inner vents of breath with a mortal wound. In great style fitted out, the son of Arsens stood in his cloak with figured needlework, all vivid Spanish blue, a brilliant sight, brought up by Mars in Mars Wood, a Cymanthan stream, and where Pelicus's altar stands, enriched by offerings, appeasable and mild. The young man had been sent to war by Arsens. Mezentius dropped his spears, then made a sling, a whipping round his head 3 times as he put stress on it, and he split the adversary's temples with a molten leaden slug, knocking him down a splay on a bank of sand. At this point, it is said, Ascanius first aimed a shaft in war. So Ascanius, Aeneas' son, is going to have his first experience in war. Line 825. In days before, he had been used to scare wild game in flight. Now, with one shot, he brought a strong man down. Numanus, Remulius by added name, who late had married Turnus's young sister. So Ascanius just killed Turnus's brother-in-law, who was fresh groom. Now this captain strode ahead and shouted boasts that had or had not dignity, inflated as he was by his new status. He swashbuckled and cried, "What? Not ashamed to be besieged again, pinned by a rampart, walling yourselves away from death? You Phrygians, Trojans, twice conquered. Look, see those who claim our wives, prizes of war. What god, what madness brought you to Italy? Here are no Atridae, Agamemnon and Menelaus. Here is no artful talker like Ulysses, Odysseus, the clever one. Tough pioneers, our stock, our newborn sons, we take to the river first, to harden them in wilderness waves, ice cold. Our boys are keen at hunting, and they wear the forests out. Their pastimes are horse taming and archery, hard labor too, and a life of poverty our young men are inured to. They can crumble earth with hoes or shake walled towns in war. Our life is worn away with iron. A spear reversed will goad an ox, and slow old age enfeebles no man's bravery or vigor. No, we press down helms on our white hair and all our days delight in bringing home fresh plunder and in good freebooter fare. So he's trying to scare them all to death, saying that even their old men fight really hard. And I lost my place. Now, no, we press down our helms on our white hair. We fight all our days, in bringing home fresh plunder and in good freebooter fare. You people dress in yellow and glowing red. You live for sloth and you go in for dancing, sleeves to your tunics, ribbons to your caps. Phrygian women, Trojans, Trojan women in truth, not Phrygian men. You're Trojan, you're just women, not men. Climb Mount Didyma. This is very close to Mount Ida. It's sacred to Cybele. Climb Mount Didyma, where the double pipes make song for the effete. Effete, we would say today, effeminate. It means you're lacking vigor, effeminate. Make song for the effete, where the small drums and the Idaean mothers, Boethian, boxwood flute are always wheedling you. Leave war to fighting men. Give up the sword. As he broadcast these insults and hard words, Ascanius could not abide the man. He turned and set a shaft on his bowstring, taut, horse-gut, and he drew his arms apart, then stood to make petition to high Jove. So Ascanius is going to shoot, but before he shoots, he says, Almighty Jupiter, only give consent to this attempt, to this venture. I shall bring thy temple gifts in my own hands each year and place a snowy bullock on thy altar, gold leaf on his brow, grown up to hold his high head high as his mother's, then to charge with lowered horns and paw the sand with hooves. This prayer the father heard. So Zeus heard his prayer. From a clear sky he thundered on the left, just as the bow sang out, freighted with doom. The springing shaft under high tension made a fearful whistle, flying to pass clean through the head of Remulus, cleaving both temples with its shank of steel. Go on, please, mock our courage with windy talk. Twice conquered Phrygians, Trojans, return this answer to the Rutulians. Only this Ascanius called out. The Trojans cheered, echoing him in joy, lifting up their hearts. At that moment, in the quarter of high air, Apollo, with flowing hair from a throne of cloud, looked down upon Ausonian, Italian troops and town. He spoke to the victor, Iulus Ascanius. Blessed be your newfound manhood, child. By striving so, men reach the stars, dear son of gods and sire of gods to come. All fated wars will quiet down, and justly, in the end, under descendants of Asarchus. And Asarchus is a son of Troas and the great-grandfather of Aeneas. So Apollo just confirmed that from Ascanius will come a great people, and of course that's the Romans. For Troy no longer bounds you. As he spoke, this is Apollo, he put himself in motion out of heaven, parting the smoothly blowing winds to make his way down to Ascanius. So Apollo's coming all the way down to Ascanius. And then he changed into an ancient man, Butes, the armor-bearer of Anchises, and faithful doorkeeper in the days of old, now an aide given Ascanius by his father. Apollo walked like Butes to the life. He had his voice, his coloring, his white hair, his grimly clinking arms, and now he said to Iulus in his ardor, let it suffice that Numanus met death by your good shot without retaliation, son of Aeneas. This feat of arms your first mighty Apollo grants you, and he feels no jealousy for the weapon matched with his. Apollo's not jealous that you were as good an archer as he was in this one effort. Of course, it's Apollo speaking. Only refrain from other acts of war. But even as he thus broke into words, midway in speech, Apollo quitted mortal vision, fading fast into thin air and distance. Dardan captains glimpsed the god and the god's bow and heard his quiver clanging as he went away. Therefore, despite his eagerness for battle, they kept Ascanius from it by command and will of Phoebus, Apollo, while they all themselves pushed forward once again to join the fight and put themselves in danger. Battle cries ran tower to tower along the entire wall as men bent springing bows or twisted thongs on javelins to whip them out. The ground was littered with flung missiles. Shields and helms rang out as they were hit, and the fierce fight mounted. How did the fierce fight mount? As when a storm out of the west, when the young goats, the rainy stars, arise, lashes the earth, or as when clouds descend in thick hail on the deep, and Jupiter goes through with south wind, making the downpour veer, and burst the cloudy arches of the sky. That's what it was like. Two brothers, son of Alcanor of Ida, Pandarus and Bitias, whom Ieria, nymph of the woods in Jove's wood, reared to manhood, tall as their native pines and hills, relying on their arms alone, unbarred, and opened the gate their captain had assigned them, daring the enemy to come in. The two then took their stand inside to right and left, before the gate towers. They were mailed in steel, their heads adorned with high and windy crests. Would they look like, as hard by rivers on the banks of Po, or near the lovely Adige, twin oaks go soaring high in air and lifted their heads into the sky with foliage uncut and nod their utmost tops? That's what they looked like. The Rutulians now stormed the entrance when they saw it clear, and in a moment Quersens and Achilles, a handsome soldier and foolhardy Tamaras, Haman as well, the son of the god Mars, with all their men were turned and put to flight, or else lay down their lives at the very gate. Their anger grew in fighting hearts. The Trojans, shoulder to shoulder, closed in on that place for combat hand to hand, and dared to sortie to attack. Elsewhere, as he raged and scattered foes, the commander Turnus heard from a messenger that bloodied with fresh kills his adversaries were offering combat at an open gate. He dropped his action in a towering rage to rush the entry and the insolent brothers. First to be brought down by his javelin cast, the first to sortie was Antiphates, bastard of tall Sarpedon by a Theban. Remember Sarpedon was a son of Zeus who fought at Troy and was killed? So this is an illegitimate son of Sarpedon. Winging through the soft air, the Italian coronal shaft sank in deep in the chest, stuck there in the black wound's open chasm, yielded a foaming wave of blood. The steel grew warm in the transfixed lung. Then with his blade he brought down Meropes and Remus, and then Amphidnus, finally Bitias, the fire-eyed, all energy of heart, not with a javelin, for he would not give his life up to a javelin. No, a pike, a great beam, given a spin with a rushing noise that struck with impetus like a thunderbolt. His shield's two bull's hides were not proof against it, nor was his coat of trusty mail with lapping scales of gold. Giant-like, he reeled and fell, earth groaned, and his great shield came thundering down. What was it like when he fell down? Line 990. Just as at Baiae, on the Euboean shore, a rocky pier, first built of massive blocks, goes over as men upended in the sea, creating surface havoc with its plunge to rest deep on the sea floor as the water seethes around it and the black sands rise, and at the crashing sound that high-peaked isle Prochoda shakes, and so does Ischia, Typius's flint bed fixed by Jove's command. It was just like that. On this, the god of warfare, Mars, instilled new heart and vigor in the Latin troops, that was line 1000, goading them on, and sent among them the Trojans, rout and black dread. The attackers flowed from every quarter. Now their chance had come, and he, the god of battle, this is Mars, Ares, swept their souls. Pandarus, seeing his brother in the dust, seeing where fortune lay, how the tide turned, pushed to shut the gate with his broad shoulders, turning it with a great heave on its hinge. He left outside a number of his own in desperate combat. So this guy, Pandarus, closed the gate, but he accidentally closed Turnus inside, and he left some of their own men outside with no hope, in desperate combat, but took others in as they turned back pell-mell. Demented man not to have seen the Rutulian prince burst in among them, close-packed there. By his free act, he shut the prince inside the town, a tiger mingling with code cattle. Turnus's eyes shone out with a new light as a deadly clang came from his armor. On his helmet crest, the plume shook red as blood, and from his shield he flashed out rays like lightning. Taken aback, Aeneas's soldiers knew that hated face and that gigantic figure. Pandarus flared up hot with rage for his dead brother, calling, "Here is no bridegroom's royal house from Amata, no Ardean inner court," because remember, Turnus was going to marry Amata's daughter, Lavinia. So this is no royal bridegroom's house from Amata, no Ardean inner court to comfort Turnus with his native walls. Your enemy's fortress camp is what you see, and not the faintest chance of getting away. But smiling calmly at him, Turnus answered, "Step forward if you have the heart for it. Come within range. You will be telling Priam Achilles has been found again." In other words, I'm a new Achilles. "And here," that was all. And the other man let fly his knotty spear shaft, bearing bank untrimmed with his whole strength. But only the blowing air incurred its flight, for Juno warded off impact and wound. It stuck fast in the gate. "Not from this blade, the stroke of my sword arm, will you escape. The man responsible for wound and weapon is no bungler." Turnus spoke and rose to full height, sword in air, then cleft the man's brow square between the temples, cutting his head in two, a dreadful gash between the cheeks all beardless. Earth resounded, quivering at the great shock of his weight, as he went tumbling down in all his armor, drenched with blood and brains in equal halves. His head hung this way and that way from his shoulders. Trojans, aghast, turned round in a stampede, and if the thought had come to the champion to break the gate bars, to admit his friends, that would have been the last day of the war, the last for Trojans. So if Turnus had just thought to open the gates and let his friends in, they could have taken over. But high rage and mindless lust for slaughter, line 1055, drove the passionate man against his enemies. He fought Phalaris first and Gyges, slashing from behind their leg tendons. Then he took their spears to throw at the backs of the men in flight, and Juno gave him heart and force. Next he dispatched Halley's to join the rest, and Phegeus his shield run through, and men still on the walls, unwary there and urging on the fight. Alcandrus, Helios, Noman, Prantus, as Lycinnes came against him, shouting out to his companions, Turnus on the rampart whirled from the right a great sword stroke and struck him one blow as he closed, taking off his head, which dropped still helmeted at a distance. Next he killed Amycus, nemesis of game, unmatched at poisoning lance and arrow points, and Clytius and son of Aeolus, and Cretheus, familiar of the muses, ever in love with glittern heart and harp and song, and tuning notes on strings, forever chanting war horses and wars and feats of arms. The Teucrian commanders at long last, hearing of carnage wrought among their people, came on the scene, Menestheus and grim Serestus, finding their troops distraught, the enemy at large inside, and Menestheus shouted at them, "Where do you think you'll run, then, after this? What walls, what fortress have you in reserve? If it is a single man hemmed in by your own ramparts on all sides, countrymen going to cause a massacre like this throughout the town and not be stopped? Will he dispatch so many of our best men to Orcus?" And remember, Orcus is the Latin name of the Roman Pluto, the Greek Hades, and he's always shown as a great big giant, hairy-headed creature, but he has a great big old wide gaping mouth. "Will he dispatch so many of our best men to Orcus? You poltroons, you cowards! Have you no shame, no pity for your own unhappy country, for the gods of old, for great Aeneas?" Burning at these words, they stiffened and stood fast in close array. Now Turnus gradually edged away from combat, moving toward the riverside, where the stream closed the camp. Fiercer at this, the Trojans, with a battle cry, began to advance against him, massing ranks. And what was that like? As when a crowd with deadly lances at the ready corners a savage lion, in his fear still dangerous and glaring balefully, he backs away, as neither wrath nor courage allows him to turn tail, yet he's unable, yearn though he may, to charge the men and weapons. Likewise of two minds, Turnus kept stepping backward in no haste, seething with rage, and even twice he turned to charge his foes, put them to flight twice, broken along the walls. But then the entire garrison on the run formed up in a solid mass, and Juno dared not give him power to match theirs. Jupiter sent out of heaven Iris, born on air, to tell his sister, that's Juno, his unkind decrees should Turnus not depart the Trojan ramparts. Therefore, neither his shield nor his sword arm availed the man to hold out in the end, stormed at by missiles from all sides. His helm rang out around his head with constant blows, the bronze dented by stones, the horsehair crest knocked off, and neither could his shield boss take the battering. Now, with redoubled force, the Trojans cast their spears. Menestheus himself, a lightning spearman, cast down Turnus's body, streaming sweat made rivers black as pitch. He could not get his breath, his gasping shook his arms and shoulders, wearied out. At last, head first in all his armor, down he plunged into the river in one leap. Old Tiber, the river, welcomed the diver in his yellow depth, buoyed him up on the surface in mild water with carnage washed away, and floated him exultant to his fellow soldiers' hands.